here, where others might content themselves with ones, I am content with zeros. Where others might be content with zeros, I am content with floating point integers. Where others might be content with floating point integers, I am content with villas. For I do not know what a floating point integer is. Ergo, if one can find oneself to be momentarily content with zeros and villas at differing opportunities, it goes without saying that one can find partial comfort with Steve Erickson's latest book, Zeroville. I do not quite understand what Steve Erickson is up to, but I do envy his Nordic hair.
Okay, so I am here with Steve Erickson, who is most recently the author of Zeroville. Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. That's good. Sounds like we're both in that kind of zone. I wanted to first of all ask you about approaching this particular book with less fantastical or abstract elements than your previous books. I'm wondering if it was a way for you to live up to Godard's maxim that cinema is essentially truth 24 frames per second.
Well, I think that in the case of this book, I because it's a book about the movies, and because I wanted the book to reflect my enthusiasm for the movies, and to reflect to some extent the obsession of the main character for the movies, I wanted to kind of follow the narrative laws of a movie. So I kept it in the present tense, and it's a pretty linear book compared to my other books, and it cuts from short scene to short scene, and it never gets too internalized. Things are told in the externals of dialogue and action, and so because of all of that, I think it had the effect of grounding the book in a way that the other books may not have felt as grounded, and also it was fixed in a very particular period of time, which is to say the 1970s in Los Angeles, when a lot of things about movies were changing, and a lot of things about the city were changing, and a lot of things were going on in terms of popular culture. So I think I don't think there was a conscious effort to make it more accessible or less surreal as such. Although I think the novel becomes more that as we go along, but there was a conscious attempt to like I say, adhere to try to capture the pop momentum of a movie.
In light of this question, I have to ask if you had Peter Biskin's Easy Rider's Raging Bulls by your desk side, because it really matches up almost perfectly at times, and it's sort of like one is tempted to kind of read both books in tandem with each other. I'm wondering if maybe you can talk about that connection, if it doesn't exist, and also about possibly this need to ground yourself this time. I mean, you're very much a writer who's very interested in ambiguities, I think, and certainly you had to resist that impulse at some point, as you did late in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I had certainly read the Biskin book, and I think, if anything, I probably resisted for a while setting the book in the same period, because I didn't want to be covering the same ground. And there was a way in which, from the standpoint of the book's sake, it would have made sense to make it more contemporary. But this was a period that I knew. This was the period where I came of age in terms of my love of movies. It just happened to coincide with the Biskin book, and it was an age in which the people who were making movies, the new wave of film of American film directors who came along, were more film conscious than any previous generation of filmmakers who who usually had come out of other things, had come out of theater, or a lot of the earlier screenwriters had been novelists. So you had this generation of film conscious directors coming along at the same time that the control by the studios was slipping into the hands of people who didn't know much about movies and didn't care much about movies. So that kind of tension was interesting to me. I think if any book was by my bedside, maybe even more than it should have been, it was a book called The Conversations by Michael Ondaatje and Walter Murch, Murch being the film editor of The Conversation and Apocalypse Now.
And who makes this little cameo appearance in this too. Yeah.
Right. And The English Patient. And the book The Conversations is a series of discussions or interviews, if you will, between the novelist Michael Ondaatje and Murch about the art of film editing. And it was a really revelatory book for me. I thought I knew a lot about movies until I read this book, and it crystallized a lot of my thinking about movies and thinking about film editing and thinking about the character who occupies the center of this particular story.
Gotcha. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that it fell into a particular narrative of trying to sort of examine where the film industry went, because one of the interesting things about this is that you have Vicar use catchphrases or dialogue from various movies, sometimes kind of evoking mantras. But it's interesting because not until the 90s, the media critics finally sort of caught up on the fact that catchphrases and sitcom banter was kind of entering the vernacular. And I'm wondering if this was kind of a wry statement on your part of sort of suggesting that, well, hey, you know, it's been there all along. We're very much emboldened or even galvanized in our vernacular in a very sort of unoriginal and kind of copying and reenacting kind of way. I have plenty of other questions along these lines, but I'll at least set this one down for now.
Yeah, I think you're on to something there. I mean, Vicar is kind of postmodern before anybody knew what postmodernism was, and I'm still not sure I know what postmodernism is, but he is, he's kind of an innocent, a naive who's very much informed by this unschooled obsession with films, and it shapes all of his reactions to things and all of the ways that he expresses those responses.
But I'm wondering, in terms of the repetition of dialogue, for example, even taking an anecdote like the Cassavetes anecdote and saying, God, I love this movie, and God, I love this book, it's almost like this kind of linguistical crux, his only way to survive. I mean, it's very evocative in many ways of Chauncey Gardner from Being There.
Well, you're not the first person who's picked up on that, and I don't know that I was conscious of that when I wrote the novel, though now that people point it out, I can definitely see it. Vicar is identified by another character in the novel as being not a cineast, but cine-autistic, and he does tend to, as you say, sponge up all of these other responses that he hears from the lips of other people, and will repeat them later at odd and incongruous moments.
There's the moment where he speaks more than four words for the first time that he arrives in Los Angeles, when he lets loose with this theory about the Western. And it's not just, I think, the catchphrases of the dialogue, but criticism itself is this kind of only way to express himself. And in fact, this leads me into sort of another observation. Late in the book, you have that Hellfire sequence that's in this block quotes, as if it's kind of a sort of annotation. It's sort of like critical writing is the only way out, almost.
Right. Well, I think the thing about Vicar is he doesn't know from film criticism at all. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a clue who Pauline Kael is. All of his love of movies is completely unmediated, and you know, he tends, you know, the outburst that you cited, you know, about the Western is something that he heard some militant black burglar say, yeah, months before, and it just sort of lodges in the seabed of his subconsciousness and burps back up at an odd time. And so I think that you know, Vicar is Vicar in one way is almost the anti-critic. You know, he doesn't, he's not interested in, there's no film 101 in Vicar's life, except for whatever odd movie that he happens to randomly walk into at any given moment.
There's also The Viking Man, which is very similar to Vicar in its phrasing, that is remotely, or actually more than remotely, resembling John Milius. Maybe we can talk a little bit about this idea of him not being able to recognize particular film figures and how the text sort of has these little clues as to who they might be, or you never really sort of deliberately mention them. Sometimes you mention, you know, oh, well, here's some guy, some arrogant director who's doing a mob movie and things like that. But then there are other very explicit references, and maybe you can talk about the decision, why you made decisions to reveal certain figures and keep some of them kind of deliberately occluded.
Well, you know, the story is always told from Vicar's standpoint. It's written in the third person, but it's a very close kind of third person. And Vicar, you know, Vicar will wander into theaters the way people wander through train stations, you know, and the movie he sees kind of blurs into the life that's going on outside the theater, and it kind of blurs into his childhood, and it kind of informs his psyche. And so it was important that the voice telling the story, and the voice that dominates the book, would remain true to the way Vicar would see things. And so if there were moments when I felt like Vicar was registering the title of a given movie, then it would be registered in the book as well. Otherwise, the movies and these people who he meets, who at the time are not yet famous,
yeah,
are just people, they're captured in the novel in the way that Vicar perceives them.
There's also his model church that he has, that he refers actually at one point, he says every building has a front story and a back story, which is very interesting, because are we talking backstory or front story in narrative, or are we talking stories as a component to the actual building?
Right.
So I want to ask you about this particular interesting symbol, which can be viewed in many different ways. I mean, is it puritanical? Is it something that represents kind of his purity? Because he also mentions that, you know, he cheats on Elizabeth Taylor and the like. So, but it's very much a symbol that is a Rorschach test to the reader. For a symbol along these lines, do you need to have something that can be sort of a piece of ambiguity that can be read any number of different ways by any number of different readers?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the case of this particular story and this particular character, he's a theology student, and he grows up in this extremely repressive, rigid household that doesn't allow for movies, and he doesn't see his first movie until relatively late in his life, when he's studying theology at a divinity school. And as you say, he constructs this model of a church, but what the review board at the divinity school doesn't know is that inside the church, where the altar should be, there's a little movie screen.
Yeah.
And And Vicar, you know, is pointed out to Vicar that there's no way in, and Vicar responds, actually, it's more a case of there being no way out. And that kind of alludes to the sense of the unconscious sense of being imprisoned that Vicar feels. And later on, the model, you know, without giving too much away about the story, the model starts to take on more importance as his obsession with movies starts to consume him.
Yeah. Well, it's also reminiscent of a reenactment. There's very much a reenactment theme in this book, particularly when you describe the, of course, CBGBs, which is reconstructed on the Columbia lot, and you describe it as basically being envisioned by someone who had no idea what the territory looked like. And it was very reminiscent to me of Tom McCarthy's Remainder, which also dealt with a protagonist who is trying to recreate or reenact in order to sort of find this particular meaning. The reenactment theme kind of finds itself midway through the book, and I was wondering, was this something that was very much on your mind, or were you in the process of kind of, I guess, organically stumbling upon certain themes along these lines, or were you just deliberately keeping things ambiguous?
I think it's sort of all of the above. I mean, I was definitely stumbling. I mean, this novel was unusual to me in how easily it wrote itself. I think all of my novels have been like that. I don't calculate to a great extent the novels I write before I write them. I am a big believer in the creative subconscious, and I kind of like to let it go where it's going to go. But in the case of this novel, I thought about it for a long time before I wrote it, and it was a case where everything just sort of fell into place, and I don't know that I fully understand all the reasons for why certain things unfolded the way they did.
Do you actually understand all the ambiguities in your book, or is it just more important to just kind of produce it and put it out there and leave, you know, all manner of grad students to dissect through it?
Yeah, I don't worry about understanding all the ambiguities when I'm writing the book, that's for sure. Later on, as I'm going back over the book, I'll think more. I'll think harder about why I've done certain things, especially if I feel like the answers are going to necessarily dictate other decisions. But I am a pretty instinctual writer, and I tend to believe in listening to my instincts more than anything else. And I do believe that novels can have secrets from their author.
Is there any sort of situation in which the meaning is perhaps too clear for you, and maybe this kind of butts heads with your natural sort of instinct as a writer? Or?
Well, I don't know that I go out of my way to be obscure, and I don't know that I go out of my way to be ambiguous. I do like novels that don't tie up every loose end. And in a lot of my novels, I think the loose ends that the readers, for better or worse, the loose ends that readers expect to get tied up don't. And often the loose ends that readers didn't expect to get tied up or didn't even know were loose ends when they wrote it, sometimes do. I like that kind of surprise and uncertainty.
The burglar character who you alluded to earlier, I'm wondering if he, in a certain way, represented the kind of blaxploitation genre in a certain way, because he kind of enters into the equation. If we look at this book as a kind of timeline of cinema,
right,
he enters in precisely that moment when blaxploitation took off.
Yeah, right. He's right there around around the time of Superfly, yeah. And later on, what was it? Coffee and
Shaft, of course.
What was the other Pam Grier movie, along with Coffee?
I'm unfortunately blanking out. It's the revenge flick one.
Yeah. Well, they're both kind of revenge flick films, and they're both kind of variations on each other. But yeah, he's definitely coming along at that a moment.
Foxy Brown. Sorry.
Pardon me.
Foxy Brown.
Exactly. Foxy Brown, which I think came after Coffee. I think that. I liked the incongruity of Vicar coming to Hollywood, thinking he's in the film capital of the world, thinking he's everybody's going to be as besotted with movies as he is, finding that in fact nobody seems to care about movies at all. That the rock and roll culture has taken over, and then he has this black militant burglar break into his apartment one night, who knows all about Joan Crawford and Betty Davis movies. And on the one hand, I thought the absurdity of that was funny, but on the other hand, there was something about it that, to me at least, sort of distilled the truth of movies and the way movies cut across certain lines, and the way movies captivate us in ways we might not have expected.
There's one thing I also wanted to ask about, and we haven't even touched upon Vicar's tattoo. There's a moment later in the book when he goes to Spain, and it's very interesting because he's asked to wear a ski cap, and he's also blindfolded, and essentially this, his flesh, which represents a kind of marker or almost a kind of topographical bearing towards anyone who's willing to be into film, and yet they can't identify that thing. It struck me as a really funny irony that here's a guy who has a salient symbol on his head of film culture that no one can identify, and then when he is sort of let loose into an entirely different region of the world, he then must cover it up.
Right.
I wanted to sort of ask you about the idea of flesh as it's almost Ballard-like to a certain degree, this notion of flesh as a kind of marker or signifier of self in terms of the symbol of a tattoo of like.
Yeah, I don't know how much, I can't remember if we've talked about the fact that he has tattooed on his head the images of Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor from A Place in the Sun, because he thinks, because these are the two most beautiful people in the history of movies, and there's something especially dreamlike and just quintessentially romantic about that image. When he goes to Europe, he's advised by Viking Man to cover his head because there's a kind of stigmatic quality about this image on his head that freaks people out, and there's a kind of proto-punk quality about it that kind of freaks people out.
But he's also an autistic, and it's almost interesting to me that here is this great punk character, or this person who's going to essentially be the revolutionary filmmaker, and yet he's essentially autistic. Again, this great delicious irony of essentially anybody can be a rebel, and so what's the point of being a rebel?
This is a business, where hairdressers become extremely successful producers, or gigolos hanging around the pool at the Beverly Hilton happen to, bump into Norma Shearer, and 2 years later they're running Paramount Studios. So where, as you say, the kind of social flotsam winds up running a movie. I did wonder at one point whether I I should do more with the story to make Vickers transition into this life as a film editor more credible to rational people, and I realized that the less I explained it, the less I justified it, the more it made sense in terms of what really happens in the movies.
And you were also going to probably take away from the quirky comedy that goes throughout the book. I mean, you have to have. I mean, it's very much sort of flamboyant moments throughout, including the press conference.
Yeah,
in
because
which
people don't know if this is some kind of genius or a savant of some kind or is just dim, you know. I liked that ambiguity too.
The parabolic arc of this book, in the sense that you have ascending chapters and then descending chapters, likewise patterning the left side, right side situation that Vicar is dwelling upon. How did this come about? Was it sort of a, I guess, did patterns kind of make themselves known throughout the course of writing? And also kind of tangentially related to this, I know I'm throwing a lot of questions at you, but did you write each of these chapters in one sitting? Was it just kind of like a burst kind of writing scenario? Or?
Pretty much. The unwinding of the chapters, the building of chapters, and then the countdown of chapters back to zero was another one of those intuitive things that I didn't think about too much. I knew I wanted those numbers, you know, because it seemed like a Godardian conceit that was appropriate for the book. The chapters just kind of impose this organizing principle on the book as much as anything else, as well as this sense that Vicar alludes to later on, without saying too much about how the book ends, of things sort of resetting to zero, the city and his life and the movies.
I hope you'll forgive me, but this countdown of chapters was reminiscent, as well as another symbol of the book, of Chuck Palahniuk's Survivor, which he did the exact same thing. But also, the fact that you have a single frame in this is very much a part of Fight Club. And I have to ask you about was Palahniuk even a possible influence? I know that's more popular and middlebrow, but
I don't think so, you know, but I see what you're getting at, and you know it. Influences are always a hard question, because sometimes I think some of the influences that make the biggest impact are the ones you're not aware of, and I know that I've gone back and read novels that I read when I was much younger, and will stumble across something that I realize had a big impact on something I wrote later on, and I had completely forgotten.
There's also, going to this picture, this single frame, the fact that I call it a picture frame is probably a telltale sign of what it entails, but essentially, Vicar holds on to this frame, which is very interesting for a number of reasons. One, it's this small, minuscule unit of a reel, which is just, there's infinitesimally other frames for another reel. But also there's this idea of, well, this is essentially the origin of film, because it started off with photography went into that. Again, very much like the model of the church, this is a symbol that can be read in multiple ways. And I'm wondering, is it meant to, I guess, be part of that element of the subconscious that you find very instinctive and rewarding,
and you know, it was sort of, you know, it was inspired in part by the von Sternberg quote that opens the novel. I believe cinema's been here since the beginning of the world. I don't know if I'm getting that exactly right, but something like that.
Well, going back to this idea of Vicar cheating on Elizabeth Taylor again, here's a character who is possessed of an extraordinary purity. Was this really the only way you can comment upon some of the hypocrisies of Hollywood or some of the kind of grand ironies of hairdressers becoming producers, to imbue him with such a really pronounced purity?
Well, yeah, I don't know how much of it I thought of in terms of a pronounced purity, but I thought of it in terms of a pronounced childlike quality, which is the same thing, I think, and a naivete and an innocence, which, as with children, can have both a benign and more violent results.
There's also one thing we haven't talked about is the mantra fuck continuity, which occurs throughout the book, but there's one point where you say fuck continuity, or you have a man say fuck continuity, perhaps that is the way to conduct this heroic quest, which again ties back to the Western speech that he delivers right at the very beginning. But I'm wondering also if that might sort of be a way to to address the reader, in the sense that this is a book that could be read out of sequence, or this is something that can be read linearly, or what?
Yeah, I mean, at least a few people have suggested this was my comment on my own work and the novels that have preceded this one. You know, I liked that sense of, you know, I mean, all movies are in fact shot out of continuity, and film editors, one of their jobs is to try and to pull a kind of continuity together in the film. And Vicar resists that and believes that that a continuity is kind of at odds with the truth. Something that I think, again, alludes to the ending of the book that I don't want to say much about.
The other thing I wanted to mention, you were talking about Vicar as this representative of anti-criticism, but it's almost as if you have the sort of occluded figures of major film people almost as kind of representing kind of anti-context in a way. And I'm wondering, I don't necessarily think that entirely deals with Vicar's childlike perspective, but I think it has something to do with, I guess, almost as if this book represents an inversion of what one is to expect when setting foot in Los Angeles or Hollywood.
Yeah, I you know, Vicar has come to L.A. with very unrealistic notions of what, I mean, he has a childlike he has a childlike idea of what L.A. is going to be and what Hollywood is going to be, almost an Oz-like quality. And, you know, he's, you know, from the very beginning, he's being challenged by that preconception, even as he in turn is trying to challenge it.
By having Vicar go off to New York and Spain, is this your way of suggesting the pervasive influence of Hollywood?
I guess so. I mean, it just it seemed like a natural place to take him. You know, I don't know how much thematic is behind that, but it seemed. But given what happens in the story, it seemed natural that he would go to those places, and it also, you know, it also alludes to the way in which he really resists being torn away from Los Angeles, even as Los Angeles has kind of betrayed his notion of what it's going to be.
But if his story is also a heroic quest, perhaps it's more of the Candide than anything else.
And I think that probably happens in my novels a lot. You've got obsessive characters who wind up covering a lot of landscape, both geographically and metaphorically, to find this obsession.
I'm wondering if the way to sort of find a narrative in an episodic structure is to have, I guess, repetitive lines and sentences and dialogue and images. Is this really kind of the way for you to kind of guide your way to the end of a book, or is it more, less instinctive or less calculated than that?
It's less calculated. That's the kind of thing that when I'm writing the book, I'm not thinking about too much, and I'm doing things that kind of come to me intuitively, and hoping that they don't, that the effect never seems too contrived, which is another reason I think that I like to leave certain ends loose.
In terms of contrivances or cliches, I mean, it seems to me that you would probably work very hard to ensure that these didn't happen by, I guess, thinking about the subtext or what lies underneath a particular image. I mean, is this kind of a question you grapple upon when working on a book? Or?
Well, I think that, you know, my brain tends to work in patterns to a fault. In earlier novels there are even more elaborate patterns that I found myself at the time having to kind of stop myself from spinning out ad infinitum.
Yeah.
Because I worried that it would seem calculated.
When do you know that a pattern seems calculated or too much?
You know, it's just a gut feeling. You know, it's a thing you feel more than you know.
Gotcha. Well, Steve, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ed. It was a pleasure to do.
Great. Thanks.